If I were to be asked what passage of Scripture is most misinterpreted and used outside of its context in all of the Scriptures, we've arrived at that passage. And I say that not just because it's a difficult one to have discussions about and have a variety of viewpoints. I say that because I don't think I've ever heard anybody in the right ballpark about this verse. Let me read to you Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. I hope this morning that as we arrive at this passage, what I'm about to say is not going to come as a large shock. And in fact, what I'm about to say, you're going to be like, yeah, of course. That's what Paul's been talking about all this time. Because if we look at almost every teaching about this passage, or every discussion about this passage, or every theological debate about this passage, we're going to see it is, if we were to engage in that sort of discussion, we would be approaching the book of Philippians and be like, all right, so Paul says, I am so thankful for your participation in the gospel from the first day until now, and I want you to know that I am now in prison, but God is not bound. In fact, my imprisonment has actually led for the further advancement of the gospel into the Roman Imperial Guard, and I am thankful that you are praying for me, and I ask you that you would pray that by your prayers and the provision of the Spirit, this is going to work out to my deliverance. And whether I'm put to death or whether I'm alive, that I am going to continue on. And I'm actually convinced I'm going to live on because I see the need for me to help you in this participation of the gospel. And I hear that you're about to go through the same conflict that I'm going through. And we need to only proclaim the gospel of Christ, and we need to do so in a manner that's worthy of the glory of his name, and we need to do so by looking at his humility, and we need to look out for the interests of others instead of ourselves. And by the way, you need to earn your salvation. All right, now back to the gospel being proclaimed and beholding it in the midst of a perverse and okay, that's the exegetical nightmare that happens to these words. Just for some reason, out of nowhere, in the context of this book, we pluck up these verses, and one side's like, you need to really work on your salvation, or else you're not going to get there. And the other side's like, no, that's not what it's saying. And we move on. Both sides are not in the ballpark of the meaning of this passage. And I'm not here this morning to just kind of be like, we've got it. I want us to see what this passage means and realize we've got work to do about what it actually means. I had started with a you are here spot in my notes. But like, all right, let's look back in this passage, in this passage, in this passage. And then I looked at the size of my notes and that's not going to happen. So I took it out, but I think I just rambled through it anyway. So you are here in the book of Philippians. We're going to see that as we study this out. There are a few things that contribute to some of the misunderstanding of this. First of all, a lot of people say, oh, I believe in studying a book in context. And what they mean when they say that is in a theological context. And there are times that theology helps us. And there are times theology helps us stay on track. I'm not saying it's always terrible to have a theological context in mind. Just derive that theological context from the Scriptures and don't use that theological context to avoid the Scriptures. But there's also something else that contributes to the difficulty with this passage. For some reason, the translators did not do us any favors. And there are two words in this passage that we're going to talk about that contribute to it kind of missing what we're supposed to be saying. The only thing that I didn't take out of my notes on the "you are here" is I want us to see Paul's working up to giving two individuals that we should look at as examples about everything he said so far. Timothy and Epaphroditus. And so in the "you are here" thing, let's look where we're going to be. We're here, but we are working our way to Paul saying, look at Timothy, Philippians 2:20. I have no one else like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. Does that sound like something we've seen recently? For most others seek their own interests. Does that seem like something we just read about, seeking interests of others instead of their own interests? But instead of those of Jesus Christ. But you know Timothy's proven worth, how as a son with a father, he has done what? Served me in the proclamation of the what? Gospel. And then Epaphroditus in 2:29. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for what? The work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. We'll talk about that verse later, but you see, the two big examples are, look at these men serving the gospel, which is what we're being called to do. So let's get into it, verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only is in my presence, but much more in my absence. Does this sound familiar to us? Is there a little ringing in our ears of, I think Paul's already addressed this. I think this is a restatement of something, not just something out of the blue. I hope it does, because there are very unique phrases in here to the rest of the Bible that we've already seen Paul use in Philippians. But again, if we pluck this out of its context and we see the word obedience, we're like, ooh, guess you need to work on that for your salvation. You've been obedient, but be more obedient. Obedient to what? Has Paul already commended them for what they are doing in obedience to God? Yes. We're not left to speculate here what this obedience is that he's talking about in Philippians chapter 2, verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, go back to chapter 1, verse 3. Paul opens this letter written to them saying, I thank God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy because of what? Your partnership for the gospel. The koinonia, the fellowship of we all are about the gospel. You're supporting me as I'm preaching the gospel, Paul says, and I'm supporting you as you all are engaged in the very same thing where you are. I am so thankful that every time I pray, always making every prayer of mine, I'm always thankful for you all with joy. That's how much this obedience has been always on Paul's mind. You all have given up everything to be partners to the advancement of the gospel. Verse 6 of chapter 1, and I'm sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Christ. So he who began a good work in you, what was the work? Their participation in the fellowship of the, or for their participation for the advancement of the gospel, which God started in them. God is doing a work in them. Keep that in mind, because he's going to reference that here soon. Paul says in verse 7, it's only right for me to feel this way about you all because I hold you in my heart. For you all are all partakers with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and the confirmation of the gospel. That's what Paul is referring to when he says, therefore, beloved, as you have always obeyed. He's talking about that obedience. To give up everything else and seek the advancement of the gospel and support Paul as he is advancing the gospel and receive his encouragement and exhortation for them to engage in the same conflict. Chapter 1, verse 27. Paul says this: "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent." Did you catch that? That's what we see in chapter 2, verse 12. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence." This is referring back to the same thing. This isn't something plucked out of nowhere. This is exactly Paul reinforcing what he's been saying. "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I may hear" what? "That you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side" for what? "The faith of the gospel." It's so clear what he's referring to here. When Paul says in Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, "Therefore, my beloved," the beloved is referring to his partnership with him for the advancement of the gospel. How much he loves them, how much they love him, how much they're involved in his life, he's involved. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed," and he's already mentioned what they've obeyed in. He doesn't specify something different here, and he doesn't leave it for us to be like, "I wonder if he's talking about their obedience to the Ten Commandments. I wonder if they're obedient to..." He's talking about their obedience to go forth and preach the gospel. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not as in my presence, but even much more in my absence." So the very opening of verse 12 ties into everything he's spoken and written to them of up to this point of now. "I'm awaiting the outcome of a trial. I can't just come visit you. When I was with you, we enjoyed this partnership for the gospel. I've heard of your continued faithfulness and the support that you're sending to me, and I'm going to be sending somebody back to you to reciprocate and do that as well. But now I could be put to death. I may remain here for some time. In my absence, keep being obedient to preaching the gospel." All right, verse 12. Getting to the tough part here. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence," the ESV translates it, "work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." All right. Work. Is that a common word in the New Testament?
Yes.
Yes. Is this the Greek word that is the Greek word that's used common in the New Testament? I love David. The first one's like, "Yes," and now he's like, "Probably not, if I can tell the tone that you're on here." Spot on, David. You can't see that here in the English text. It's W-O-R-K. I don't know. Look up the word "work" in a concordance. You have no idea which Greek word's behind it. Okay. This is a different word than is even used twice in verse 13. We'll get to the word that we see a lot of times. And that's the word ergon, work. And ergon's at the root of a bunch of other words. First of all, the word ergon is basically the equivalent in many cases to the English word "do." Let me ask you a question. Did you do that? I want an answer. Did you do that?
No.
You did?
No.
You didn't? What am I referring to? You don't know, do you? Because the word "do," I just used it myself. It's everywhere. It's such a general word. It basically just has to do with something that's done. It's a very common word. It's not always indicating some religious work, but it can be used of religious works. So we'll get to the really common word ergon in a moment, but there's all sorts of ways that ergon is adapted and used with other prefixes, suffixes type things. Just like in English, we do that, and it changes the meaning of the word, or it brings a certain aspect to the meaning of the word. And the word translated just as work here, work out your own salvation, is not the word energeia. So you hear that ergon. It's not the verbal word that's often energeia. That word is used 21 times in the New Testament, and ergon is the noun type, and that's used 169 times in the New Testament. This is the word katergatsomai. So you still get the ergon root in there somewhere, but on the front of it, you've got kata. And I've talked about this prefix often in the Greek, and I'm not trying to run the root fallacy. If you just take the root fallacy, that means you take the word, you apply this, and you think, oh, it must always mean this. If you take the word chair in English, and you take the word high and put it on the front of it, and you've got high chair, you may be thinking of something grand and split. Maybe that's a kingly chair, not something for a baby or an infant. That's the root fallacy, is you just take type thing. So I don't want to do that today. We're going to get into how the word is found to be used in ancient Greek documents. But if we do look a little bit at kata on the front of it, how have I often kind of given a visual indication of what kata is? Kata. Dr. Tomlinson, my old professor, did that. He loved mnemonic things, and so he'd be like, kata in class, and it was fun because it was weird, and people in the hallway would be like, what's going on in there? And this is Greek that we're doing this in. Kata, when added to a word, is often in some way indicating that now the word is being used not in the truly positive sense, but now in a way against or an attack of something. And it's not, again, don't take this too far. Don't do the root fallacy to where it always means this. But you get the idea. Something's different about this. This isn't just, hey, go out and work. Go out and do good deeds. This is work against kata. This word, katergatsomai, is used 22 times in the New Testament. It's not the one that's used, 200 times. 13 of the times it is used in negative works, works against. Romans chapter 7, verse 13. Did that which is good then bring death to me? By no means. It was sin, katergatsomai. It was sin working against me, producing something against that went against my good. It's the same word used in Romans 7:8. But sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, did something against me, produced in me all kinds of covetousness. So this word that we find here, therefore, my beloved, as you've always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work against. That's really what the word is. Work against something. Well, that really troubles us. Wait a minute. Work against your own salvation. What? Here are the definitions where Bauer's Lexicon has researched the Bible itself and then all sorts of first century documents found in caves and all sorts of other places. Just getting all these documents and just looking at the way the word is used, not just in religious language, but everywhere. Four definitions to the word katergatsomai. Number one, to achieve, accomplish, or do something. Okay. Number two, to bring about, produce, or create something. Three, to prepare someone for something. And in most of these cases, it's usually a negative. It's usually against them. Number four, David, do you think this is where I'm headed? To overpower, subdue, or conquer. When you see the word katergatsamai in a document describing the history of warfare, or you see it used in a document that talks about history whatsoever, and you see it in light of battle, it is talking about overpowering, subduing, and conquering an opponent. Is Paul's letter using military language throughout it? Yes. Do you think we ought to give some thought about this word implying its military context here? Absolutely. Is this passage at all talking about be a good person and work out your own salvation so that you can go to heaven? No. And I don't have to just kind of ignore it and be like, yeah, I don't think that's really what it means. In its context, it is saying, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed and been faithful to preaching the gospel, so now, not as just in my presence, but much more in my absence, keep conquering. All right, so now we've got to deal with the other word. Battle out, conquer, subdue, or overpower your own salvation. Okay, now we look at the word salvation, soterion. Is this salvation in a... Okay, does the Bible speak of salvation in a spiritual sense? Yes, absolutely, a lot. Does the Bible use the word salvation ever in a physical sense? Yes, a lot. Wait, what? We never think about that when we just see the word salvation, do we? We're Christians here. We like salvation. We talk about salvation. You talk to others. You need salvation. I'm saved, saved, saved. When we see the word salvation, and especially not only in a religious teaching, a Christian setting, but in the Bible, our minds go to spiritual salvation. I am saved from my sin. Again, is that Paul's context here? See, is he talking about man? I thank God always because I think you're getting close in every prayer of mine. I keep thinking that you're getting there. And I want you now, not only in my presence when I'm there saying you need to get there, but now much more in my absence. You need to somehow achieve your salvation with fear and trembling. It's not at all the context of this book. Could the word soterion here be talking about not salvation from sins, but deliverance among enemies in the battle? Has it already been used that way? And the translators were bold enough to do it then. Yes. Look at Philippians 1:19. According to the ESV. For I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my soterion. And the ESV says, let's use deliverance there, because this is not spiritual salvation. Now again, can you be spiritually delivered from sin? Yes. Can you be saved from sin? Yes. Both words could be used, but just in our minds, we quickly see salvation to be spiritual and deliverance to be more physical. Even you know, looking at those that have deliverance ministries, they use deliverance not from sin, but from sickness or poverty or things like that. It's just the way in our minds we use that English term, even though they can mean the same thing and they can be totally interchangeable. But the ESV is like, yeah, let's go with the one that's not talking about. Paul's not saying, by your prayers, I can be saved. He's not saying that. He's saying, by your prayers, I can be delivered from Rome that has me in captivity right now. And he describes that. They may put me to death, in which I'm free, I'm delivered, I'm with Christ, which is far better. Or they may release me. And I think that's probably what's going to happen, because I see I'm going to be delivered from this to help you all. So Paul's already used that very word in this context to refer to himself being freed from his opponents. And then in 127, we've already read this, Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or whether I am absent, I may hear you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and you are not being frightened in anything by who? By sin in your heart that may keep you from being saved? No. By your opponents. This will be a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation. Is it a sign to them that you are saved, or a sign to them that God is delivering you from them? I would argue this should be deliverance here as well. The context is clear. So, with that context in mind, Paul also says that you all are now engaged in the same conflict. See it there in chapter 1, verse 30? You are now engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had and hear that I still have. So Paul said, you've seen the conflict that I'm having. I'm asking you to pray and for the power of the Spirit to deliver me. Let's now talk about you. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed in obedience to proclaim the gospel, so now, not only is in my presence, but now much more in my absence, conquer and vanquish. Go forth in your own deliverance. Paul said, I've talked to you about my deliverance. Now let's talk about yours. You're going to be engaged in the same conflict. You're going to need to be delivered from your enemies too. So, battle out your own deliverance. So how do we put the rest of this together? With fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both the will and the work for His good pleasure. All right, first of all, does this sound familiar to us? And I hope it does, and I hope it also is like, well, wait a minute. It does sound familiar, but now it sounds different. Because, yes, I remember now that God is working in us. I remember back in chapter 1, the way Paul started this thing. Look, I am confident that the one who started a good work in you will complete it all the way until the day of Christ Jesus. But I also remember Paul saying, don't be intimidated or afraid at all of your opponent. This will be a sign to them that they're fighting a power they're not going to win. This is going to be a sign of their destruction. And that you are going to be delivered ultimately. Don't be afraid of them. Why now does he say, all right, talk about my deliverance. Now let's talk about your deliverance. And I want you to go forth conquering and vanquishing. And I want you to see that you yourselves are also going to be delivered by God with fear and trembling. Now, is the fear and trembling describing what was preceding it? Or does fear and trembling refer to what goes after it? With fear and trembling, because none of your opponents, don't be afraid of them, but do this with fear and trembling. Why? Because the Almighty is at work in you to vanquish the kingdoms of darkness. Tremble not for them. Do not fear those who can kill the body, but rather the one who controls our very spirit. Don't tremble at how wicked they are out there. With fear and trembling, realize how much you are serving the kingdom of Christ. And God Himself is at work in you. Don't fear them. Fear Him. And approach this work with obedience. This conquering with obedience. This calling to be advancing the gospel. Not fearing them, but fearing Him. Indeed, We are to have a fear and trembling when we realize Almighty God is working in us to do His good pleasure against the crooked and twisted generation we live in. All of these passages that say, don't fear them, don't return evil for evil, don't revile them in return, but be gentle, be gracious. All of these passages aren't to be like, just pretend everything's good. Just pretend like there's nothing really important going. It's not what these passages are saying. What it's saying is we need to understand how big the battle is. God Himself started a good work and is going to finish it through us. Paul said, I'm confident of that. What about us? Are we confident in that? If we're not, we're going to do what we looked at in 2 Corinthians earlier this morning. We're going to be tempted to give up hope. We're going to be tempted to look and be like, all right, we're just this, but they are that. Looking at it wrong. Don't be afraid of your opponents at all. Look at what God Himself is doing through the church. Take heart with fear and trembling, because it is God who is working in you to do what? To accomplish His will. To work for His good pleasure. May we be obedient to proclaim the gospel of Christ. May we look to vanquish, overpower, subdue, and conquer the world around us as we hold forth the word of life we're going to see next week. For the glory of Christ. Let's pray.